we saw was a complete breakdown in global solidarity around that, because the meager supplies that were available and the vaccine that took more than 6 months to get online only went to the rich countries. And the poor countries, the middle-income countries, were all left going, oh, what about us? And it gave a clear indication, this is what we will do in an epidemic. We'll take care of the rich, and the rest of you, eh, maybe there's some aspirin. Well, these folks in Liberia aren't even getting the aspirin.
Cuba announced it's sending 165 health workers to help address the Ebola outbreak in West Africa. A team of doctors, nurses, infection specialists will be stationed in Sierra Leone for 6 months. Cuba's Minister for Public Health, Roberto Morales Ojeda, made the announcement at a World Health Organization press conference on Friday in Geneva.
We will cooperate with a brigade of 165 collaborators, made up of 62 doctors and 103 nurses, all of them with more than 15 years professional experience, and who have worked in other countries facing natural and epidemic disasters, and who have also worked in medical cooperation missions, with 23% participating in more than one international mission.
Meanwhile, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation has donated $50 million to the relief effort. The Financial Times writes, quote, Raul Castro and Bill Gates may not be the most natural allies, but the pair have emerged at the forefront of international efforts to combat the Ebola outbreak ravaging West Africa. Cuba putting the U.S. to shame, Lori?
Well, I don't know about to shame, but the one genuinely strong asset Cuba has is trained primary health care workers, and they have a long tradition of flying them into places of need and being available to respond. And, well, they'll obviously be very well welcomed on the ground in Sierra Leone. Now, the problem is, where are they going to work? I mean, there aren't enough hospital beds, there aren't enough facilities. Exactly how will they be doing patient care? And the one thing I would caution about with the Cubans is that they do not have experience working in PPE suits under maximum protective care. And this is really tough. This is why people are getting infected. You know, it's 120-plus degrees centigrade inside one of those suits. After about an hour in that kind of heat, coupled with the emotional tension of dealing with this disease, people start to get sloppy. You develop fatigue. You don't quite notice where this syringe is vis-a-vis your fingers and your protective suit. And this is how accidents are occurring. It's a sloppiness. It's a fatigue. And it takes a special kind of skill set to be able to work under these conditions. It's interesting to note, MSF has been the major responder from day one. They still are the number one responder.
Doctors Without Borders.
Doctors Without, and they have not had any of their people infected. So they know what they're doing. And everybody, the Cubans included, should go through huge training with MSF before they get in touch with patients.
This issue of public health and the crisis of public health also goes to the development of vaccines, because do companies really pour money into, for example, Ebola vaccines when they think they won't be making money? Talk about the crisis of the drugs needed to deal with Ebola.
Well, actually, Ebola was top of the list in the top 10 for Project BioShield. So here we are just a few days after 9/11 anniversary. And, of course, one of the things that happened right after 9/11 were the anthrax mailings, which resulted in members of Congress getting exposed and saying, all right, we want cures for these things. We want vaccines. We want more science. Billions and billions and billions of dollars have gone into Project BioShield 1, Project BioShield 2. Ebola vaccines were among the things on the list. There was money, a lot of money. And the NIH got a fair distance down the path on development of a potential vaccine. GSK, GlaxoSmithKline, got down the path on one, and so on. The problem is, where's the marketplace for something that may not be able to survive refrigeration for very long? You have to wait for an epidemic to occur before you will mass manufacture, because they can't just sit on shelves. And trying to come up with proper market incentives for anything like this is proving elusive at best.
Well, in a recent New York Times piece by the director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research and Policy at the University of Minnesota, Dr. Michael T. Osterholm, he warned of the possibility that the Ebola virus could someday mutate into an airborne strain. Mm-hmm. Do you agree with that? And if so, what would the implications of that be?
Well, I know Mike very well. I was a little surprised by that op-ed. There is documentation of more than 300 mutations have indeed occurred in the current circulating strain. It is unusual for Ebola to circulate through so many humans in one giant incident. This is the largest incident ever. And as a result, every time a virus goes through a different species, this is normally a bat virus, and as it comes into humans, it's mutating, it's picking up genetic material, and it's a very sloppy virus, like many RNA viruses, like flu, makes lots of mistakes when it reproduces. So it had a huge mutation rate. However, none of the mutations so far have functionally changed the virus at all. So indeed, most of the mutations have resulted in something that just died out because it didn't improve functionality. Could the virus turn into an airborne virus? Very, very unlikely, but it could be droplet transmitted. And this is the real issue. The viruses that you think of as airborne, let's take the flu as an example, the virus itself cannot exist without moisture. If you put it out on the tabletop and just let it sit there and put a blow dryer to it and you desiccate it, the virus falls apart because it needs water. It has to be in the presence of some kind of liquid. Now, in the case of flu, it's able to have sufficient fluid from your nasal or oral coughing. What you spit out, cough out, and so on is how you transmit flu. Ebola, in contrast, infects blood. And people don't spit out blood unless they're really acutely ill with something. And so transmission right now is contact. If you touch the bleeding or the sweating fluids of an individual who's infected, and then rub your nose, rub your eyes, eat some food with those unwashed hands, that's the nature of transmission. Could the virus mutate into one that could end up more airborne transmissible? Well, potentially, but it would have to then take on a respiratory cycle similar to what we see with flu. And that would be huge because the main target cells for this virus are what's called the endothelial cells, which are the cells that line blood vessels, capillaries, arteries, and so on. And the way it kills you is it pokes little holes in those blood linings and allows blood to leak and hemorrhage into the rest of your body.
Could you imagine if the world dealt with Ebola like it's dealing with ISIS right now? Right now, there's an international global summit in France. Every day, headlines across the front pages of the paper. When you're talking about the number of people killed, we're talking in the thousands, at least. What it looks like the number's around 5,000 right now, many more infected. What about that, Laurie Garrett, as we wrap up?
Well, it's interesting because I spent a lot of time talking with our military people about the Ebola response. And, of course, they're wondering, well, what does the president want us to do with ISIS? You know, we're also doing this, that, and the other thing. And many people pointed out, well, there are more than 4,000 physicians working for the armed forces in the United States. Why can't we deploy some of those into Liberia, Sierra Leone, and so on? And the response from the military leadership is, yes, and the majority of them work in the VA. And we will not put our veterans in greater risk than they already are. So we're not going to deplete our veterans' services. As you go around country by country at potential responders, you see similar crises. We're stretched thin, folks.
And jumping from one dark and sort of desperate note to another deeper and darker note, ISIS and the U.S. reaction to ISIS, we'll do that after this break.
We be, A Jihad for Love, Whitewater Black Gold, A Red Girl's Guide to Reasoning, East Hastings Pharmacy, Ai Weiwei, Never Sorry, Misrepresentation.
Cinema Politica UBC screens politically charged films with speakers and discussions every month. Screenings take place at the Norm Theater in the Sub and are by donation. To learn more, visit cinemapolitica.org/UBC.
And we're back. Currently in the news is ISIS. And no, we're not talking about Archer's place of employment, a little Easter egg for my more hipper listeners. But seriously, it's damn near impossible to watch television and not hear something about the pending Armageddon proffered by ISIS, the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, aka ISIL, the Islamic State in the Levant. For those not up on their historical geography, the Levant is an English term coined about 600 years ago and roughly refers to Iraq, Syria, Jordan, Lebanon, Israel, and Palestine, more or less, although there is no real technical definition. Getting back to the news. ISIS has, in a few short weeks, managed to capture the headlines, driving previous boogeymen like Al-Qaeda out of our mind. They have gone from a small faction fighting in Syria to become, quote, the new bully state on the block when they declared the Islamic State, which accompanies the Sunni parts of Iraq, parts of southern Syria, and some other little bits. So who are they? Well, the simple answer is, they're a radical Sunni militia. They've been around for at least 7 years, where in 2007 they stated that they wish to abolish the modern notion of the nation-state. By calling their land the Islamic State, they are harkening back to a time of the caliphates in the 10th and 15th century. But their thinking is much more revolutionary and modern than that. Not so much a devolution of the idea of a nation, but an evolution of the idea of Islam. But more on that later. The leader is one Abu Bakr al-Baghdadi, who called himself Emir or Prince, first of the Islamic State of Iraq, then the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, and now simply the Emir of the Islamic State. With each new pronouncement, he is attempting to create an Islamic State which, at its minimum, includes the historical Islamic Empire, with its goal being that Islam will eventually be the true religion of all people, and thus encompass the gold. With regards to the global Islamic State, whether it can be interpreted as a conquest by force or an act of religious conversion is of little import, as the global Islamic State is but a pipe dream. Sorry, my Muslim friends. The original fighting force of the ISIS has been estimated at just a few thousand, but those numbers have ballooned as ISIS have achieved more success and legitimacy. The ballooning of their ranks and the expansion of the territory they cover is tied with the success they've had in the region, obviously. But why or how have they succeeded when other competing militias have not gained similar success? Well, on the one hand, some have achieved similar success. As a constant counterpoint to ISIS, there's been the Kurds. They have not only gained control of a large territory, established an independent-ish government, but they've united a people. So in many ways, they are no different than the Islamic State, except they've been around a little longer, and, well, we seem to like them. And it is this united people that help us understand the success of ISIS in the land it controls. Wait a minute, I have to make a clarification, and now is as good a time to make it as any. When you look at a map of the Middle East, and they show you the territory controlled by ISIS, analogies are made that they control land equivalent to the state of Indiana or the nation of Jordan, or for a more Western-centric view, larger than Austria or Scotland, depending on who you trust. A quick note, I was going to give a Canadian reference, but saying that it's more than one-tenth the size of Manitoba seems, well, pretty weak tea. And we all love sensationalism, no? Getting back, yes, larger than Ireland. But, well, the comparison could be a little misleading. The area in question, though, is largely desert, with areas of population. A better comparison could be made with that of Imperial Japan and the vast territory it controlled in the Pacific, which, of course, was not really all that much land, but a number of strategic islands. Just for reference, the area of Japan controlled was more than 50 million square miles, but less than a tenth of that was actually land. The same is true for ISIS. They control a number of strategic cities and scads of empty land, but they do control it. Back to the question. Why has ISIS achieved success? The most obvious answer is that they have the support of the local people. Why? Well, this requires us to understand that Iraq is under the control of a Shiite government. Although ostensibly a coalition government, it's really Shiite control. In the past few months, many headlines noted troubles with al-Maliki's leadership, that because of his efforts over the past 8 years, he has secularized both the government and the security forces. When you think of security forces, think of sort of a cross between the CIA and the movie version of the KGB. Anyway, essentially he has made it a Shiite force with an overt intent of suppressing all things Sunni. It's like an act of revenge. Maliki was forced out of the government by the US and rational elements in Baghdad, his oppression of the Sunni section of Iraq has proven to be fertile ground for groups like ISIS. From the perspective of the Sunni, however harsh ISIS rule may be, they see it as an improvement over Baghdad rule. Remember, with regards to acts of barbarism enacted by ISIS, it's been directed at non-Sunni and mainly Shiite. Retribution is a common theme in war, in oppression, under Saddam. The Sunni oppressed the Shiites. When they replaced Saddam, the Shiites enacted retribution on the Sunni. Now ISIS has created the Islamic State, and the Sunnis are enacting retribution on the Shiite. Things keep going round and round. In Syria, you have a similar situation. Assad is a member of the Alawites, a Shiite minority that has ruled and oppressed its Sunni majority. With the onset of the Syrian civil war, the violence, repression, and deteriorating living conditions have only helped drive many to anyone who could offer any relief, no matter the cost. Thus, ISIS arrives, shows it can provide peace and eliminate the Shiite oppression, and all they ask in return is the implementation of an Islamic State under Sharia law. In extreme stretching of the meaning of this term, one could argue, from the Sunni perspective, ISIS is simply preaching social justice. This also helps explain how such a small group, relatively, can control such a large area. They can call in local recruits, who have, as already mentioned, ballooning their numbers, but they have also helped by enlisting allies like Nashbandi and other former Baathists. ISIS has provided a revolutionary vigor, while the Baathists can provide not only sophisticated military knowledge and experience, but thanks to the U.S. rearming the post-Saddam army, they have access to advanced and modern armaments, as well as people able to operate and train others in their use. This is why the U.S. was reticent to provide arms to the Free Syrian Army, because there was no way to ensure that these modern effective weapons would not end up in the hands of what Obama would have called fractious anti-American or religious extremist militias, like ISIS. Well, it seems from all reports that when ISIS was confronted by the U.S.-equipped Iraqi army, they dropped their weapons and fled. Why go out and shop when they deliver? There's been many a word spent claiming that ISIS is far more barbaric than anyone else in the region. Thus, they warrant special attention. This being said in the context of the Syrian government bombing its own people with poison gas, and no, it makes little difference if you think it was a Free Syrian army that had used the poison gas. In that context, beheading a couple of people and a few deaths of unarmed soldiers seems pretty weak tea. And the fact that I can call that weak tea speaks more to the tragic conditions in the region and not of the acceptability of those actions. That said, why might the ISIS leadership be more radical, more violent, more barbaric than previous leaderships? On the one hand, thanks to the oppression this region has been under, combined with the ongoing civil war, the moderates, those willing to compromise, well, they found themselves betrayed and have literally been killed off. There are no moderates left to deal with. What you have now is not the best and the brightest, those who have acted most ruthlessly and thus out-survived their rivals. But there's more than just attrition to this leadership. But more on that when we come back from this break.
SpongeBob, you're wasting me precious carbon dioxide. I'm pumping it into the atmosphere, boy. Thanks to global warming, the temperature will soon go through the roof, and then we'll have an endless summer.
Why do you want an endless summer, Mr. Krabs?
So I can open me latest money-making venture, the Krusty Pool.
The endless summer does sound fun.
And profitable.
Fun and profitable. Big business does it again.
Unfortunately, for those of us who aren't talking sponges, climate change isn't quite as fun. Luckily, there are many easy ways for students to conserve energy.
If chargers for cell phones, cameras, and laptops are left plugged in, they continue to draw electricity even when not connected to the device. This phantom load can be avoided by unplugging electronics and chargers after use. A more convenient option is to hook electronics up to a power bar, which can be switched off after use.
For more energy-saving tips, go to www.bchydro.com. This message brought to you by BC Hydro and CITR 101.9 FM Vancouver.
And we're back. So there's more to the radicalization of leadership than just attrition of leadership. These are all war-torn areas, which helps explain the, quote, radical and extreme nature of these groups and their leaders. We think the beheading of two journalists and one aid worker barbaric, but if you lived in a land where people are routinely rounded up off the streets, imprisoned, tortured, killed, where you live with the daily possibility of being beheaded by U.S. drones, to be constantly surrounded by death, destruction, and violence, well, how else can I put this? We often decry the treatment our troops receive when they return from places like Afghanistan. Many of them suffer from post-traumatic stress disorder, or PTSD. This leads many of them to substance abuse, violent behavior, and, well, they are, if I can use this term to make a point in a moment, a little nuts. Think then what it must be like to have grown up under these conditions. From our perspective, in the safe comfort of our living room, many, if not most, of the leadership of the rank and file of groups like ISIS, due at least to post-traumatic stress disorder, are nuts, some more so than others. This leads to a surreal event like Al-Qaeda disowning ISIS because they think ISIS is too violent. The people claiming responsibility for 9/11 thinking ISIS techniques are too over the top. So much so that in an effort to distance themselves from ISIS and show they are the saner terrorist group, after the beheading of Stephen Sodkloff, they made a big show of releasing one of their captives, Peter Curtis, as a peace offering, I guess, or a gesture of saying something like, "Hey, America, even to us, those ISIS dudes, they're way too crazy." And that actually brings up an interesting point. A major difference in the comparison between Al-Qaeda and ISIS. The fact ISIS proclaimed the Islamic State, Al-Qaeda makes no claim to nationhood. They're more of a methods group, using terrorism to, from their perspective, defend Islam and the Holy Lands. ISIS has set itself up as the endpoint, not the method, but the goal, the Islamic State. One way this difference has been articulated in how they treat their foreign recruits. When people join Al-Qaeda, the real prize from Al-Qaeda are their passports. Why? Because passports are tickets back into the West, where they could carry out terrorist acts. This is gold if you wish to commit acts of terror on other nations. This is the raison d'etre of Al-Qaeda. But what is the first thing you see Westerners who join ISIS do? They burn their passports. Why? Because it shows a rejection of the West, a refutation of the old and an embracement of the new, in this case, the Islamic State. ISIS has made no claims or threat against the West. Their use of terror is limited to the lands they wish to control. They have no point to make other than the establishment of the Islamic State in Iraq and Syria, for now at least. And in that, there's an important clue, Iraq and Syria. Al-Qaeda has Al-Qaeda in Yemen, Al-Qaeda in the Maghreb, and Al-Qaeda in Iraq, each tied to a nation. They just announced Al-Qaeda in India. Most, if not all, jihadi groups are acting with a national mindset. IS was proclaimed as a borderless nation, that it does not recognize national borders, that Muslims should live in one land of Islam. And that is a radical and revolutionary idea. What, you missed the point? Well, in the news, and often touted by prominent anti-Islam atheists, that what these terrorists, Islamists, jihadist types are trying to do is drag the world back to the 10th century, that they are ultra-conservative traditionalists. Well, folks, they're not. It's better to think of them as revolutionaries. They reject the traditional casual view of the religion of their parents. They do not want to return to some historical decadent period to be recast, but to create a new world where the true caliphate can live. It's akin to fundamentalist Christians who are not wanting to return to the time of Jesus, but create a new heaven on earth. They do not want to use imposed imperialist ideas of empire and nation, but they see a new Islamic State as a theocracy, God-inspired, global state, where the forces required to educate the infidel is, well, soft-pedaled, but neither is it fundamental to ISIS doctrine. These people see how their elders have allowed the Arab world to be manipulated by infidels. They are rejecting the idea of nations. By erasing the borders in the Middle East imposed by Western imperialists, they are creating a single Islamic State that they would see one day as encompassing the world, one world united under Allah, if you will. This is a radical generational shift as power in the community moves from parents to youth. It is an anti-traditional movement. It is not hard to see parallels with the social unrest of the 1960s, where you had generations of youth looking at the society they lived in and found it wanting, found it corrupt, and found themselves with nothing to believe in. In the 1960s, some focused on liberation and social justice. Some focused on anarchy and religious radicalism. Scientology, the explosion of the Hare Krishnas, cults like Jim Jones were birthed during the 70s and 60s. Revolutionary radical religion is not unique to Islam or the modern world. We see with things like the Arab Spring that youth in Muslim nations have a similar reaction, a cry for freedom and social justice. Sadly, we also see some being radicalized, falling under the sway of violent demagogues who use their longing for change and their need for belonging and creating groups like ISIS. Or if you're a Christian, the Christian Front, the Minutemen, or the Aryan Nation, just to kind of bring this idea home. One author who dismisses the correlation with jihadists and ISIS in particular with medievalism, say ISIS is less a recreation of the Umayyad Caliphate, but is owing more to the French Revolution. Republican France was birthed on the idea of a state founded on a set of principles, and thus ISIS is not a wholly new thing in this world. In revolutionary France, it is the state that creates its citizens, and nothing should be allowed to stand between the citizen and the state. Republican France was based on the principles of the Enlightenment. ISIS is founded on the principles of Islam. Just as a revolutionary French state creates its citizens, with the citizen unthinkable outside the state, so too the Islamic State creates its citizen, with their existence outside of Islam unthinkable. So claims that this group wants to return to the good old days is to fundamentally misunderstand their message. Yes, they wish to live under a strict form of Sharia law, but not like in the past, but in a new way, in a new Islamic state. Okay, that's enough about them. Let's go to the, quote, important question, the one that has exploded over the popular press. Should we be afraid? That depends on who the we are. One of the things that has made ISIS headline news is both its rapid growth, but also its moved beyond a militia and are beginning to have the features of a government. They, obviously for reasons of indoctrination, are setting up and reopening schools. They provide a respectable police. They restored running water and turned on the lights in areas that haven't seen them for years. In fact, one of the reasons we know the extent of ISIS control is they have a well-disciplined border customs. People entering ISIS territory have their passport or papers stamped. They excise tax or custom duties. They are no longer your typical guys with guns on the side of the road shaking down people for money. No, these are more akin to Canadian customs. We also know that they are trading with other nations and groups for things like oil, including, ironically enough, Syria. So if the we are those people under the control of ISIS, well, many of them have lived for years in the wreckage of the U.S. invasion. Being the Sunni part of Iraq, they have experienced discrimination and downright hostility from the Shiite-controlled government. We already discussed al-Maliki was forced to step down because much of the blame for the rise of ISIS is leveled at his harsh treatment of Sunnis in their region. So the people living in ISIS territory have a simple question. Do they want to live under the control of a distant government that is hostile, Iraq, or actively violent, Syria? Would you? Do they want to live in a place that, because of the constant violence, remains largely in ruins? That because of the absence of any good government, they live under near lawless conditions? Would you wish to continue to live under Damascus or Baghdad? Or would you prefer to live under a law and order government, one that has ended the persecution for at least your people, i.e. the Sunni? One where you can feel safe walking the streets at night, where you have the return of running water, power, and the restoration of infrastructure, the reopening of schools, something as simple as having someone control traffic in the streets, to live a more or less normal, if much more pious, life. It was these same conditions that led to the rise of the Taliban in Afghanistan, a trick they look like they're about to repeat. No, if you were Sunni living under ISIS, you might well not fear, but actually welcome ISIS and see them as more liberators. So it seems like if you were living under the ISIS government, you wouldn't have that much to fear, again, assuming you're a Sunni. If you're not a Sunni, get the hell out. But that leads open to the next question. What about the neighbors? What about the people who are living around the Islamic State? What do they have to fear? We'll answer that question when we come back after this break.
is the best tool ever devised for understanding how the world.
To subscribe to the Radio Freethinker podcast and take it on the go and download previous episodes, subscribe via iTunes or at RadioFreethinker.com. Remember to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter at CITRRFT. If you have any questions, comments, or thoughts to share with us, email at info@radiofreethinker.com. That understanding empowers you.
Okay, so we were just talking about what it's like to live under the ISIS leadership. And again, if you're a Sunni, it seems to be okay. But there's a lot of people around the Islamic State that aren't Sunni. So what should they think? Well, let's discuss that. If you're a neighbor of ISIS, is there cause to be fearful? Likely very little directly. There is a chance that ISIS can still find Lebensraum in Syria, but the fighting seems to have ground to a halt. There are parts of Lebanon and Jordan that may be sympathetic to ISIS, but the military of those regions are in a much better position to stop ISIS at the border. They will likely have a strong effect on Iraq, not because they will conquer more land. It seems they have battled the Kurds to a standoff, and considering their near genocidal actions to non-pure Muslims, i.e. Shiites, they would never survive the bloodbath that would ensue if they moved south into Shiite-dominated and more populous regions of Iraq. No, their effect on Iraq will not be territorial, but will likely signal the end of Iraq itself. The quote, nation of Iraq may still exist on a map, but de facto, it has become such a decentralization that the term nation seems misapplied. The Kurds have already been largely autonomous for years. The dictatorial rule of the Shiites have, beyond alienating the other groups in Iraq, solidified an independent Shiite identity focused on the southern third of Iraq. And now ISIS has, quote, liberated the Sunnis and created the tripartite that most analysts predicted would be the outcome of the U.S. invasion a decade ago, referring to the three parts as Kurdistan, Shiitestan, and Sunnistan. Okay, so that's great for them. But people in the West never really seem to care about anything beyond their own concerns. To the really important question, if I may channel your typical Westerner, what threat are they to me, here in Canada, the U.S., or wherever in the, quote, West? One thing to note, regardless of the current headlines, ISIS has been gaining strength for a couple of years. They had a big splash when they captured Mosul and started the inevitable fall of al-Maliki. But they were not an existential threat until the beheading of the U.S. journalists. This was taken by the war hawks, the popular media, and opportunists to be a threat to the United States. First the journalists, then you. No one is safe. Nothing is sacred. More nuanced analysts believe the very visible, deliberate, orchestrated message was really to tell the West, and more specifically the U.S., to back off. You're not welcome here, and if you come, this is what you can expect. It was not a threat, but a warning. Sadly, I think I mean sadly, I'm not sure on that, but irrespective, they misjudged. I think they assumed that if they gave the U.S. a little push, it would do what it's been doing for almost a decade now in the region, try to further disengage. That Obama was milk toast and would say that there was a red line, make a lot of noise, but ultimately do nothing. And that may have been the case had they done almost anything else. But the U.S. psyche is a tricky beast. The beheadings have triggered America's PTSD over 9/11. And instead of kicking the sleeping bear's arse, they poked it in the eye. The very act they hope to reduce U.S. involvement has caused a marked increase in U.S. engagement that may ultimately lead to the reintroduction of ground troops. Our own trigger-happy militarist government has already committed Canadian Special Forces to the battle. Of course, I have not actually answered the question, should we, here in Canada, the US, the UK, be afraid? Is ISIS the new, more radical Al-Qaeda? The short answer is no. Al-Qaeda's raison d'etre was to drive the US out of Saudi Arabia by bringing the wars of the Middle East to the shores of America. And that's how you got 9/11, 7/7, and 3/11. ISIS, though, more specifically the Islamic State, has no real truck with the U.S. or the West in general. The area they set up shop is relatively free of Western interest. In fact, if they had not done the beheadings, they would likely have been able to continue to set up shop provided their expansion was contained, which, as we've already discussed, it largely had been. It would, as I already said, be a repeat of the Taliban in Afghanistan. ISIS has no history of terror attacks of the kind we should be worried about. They used terror, no one can deny the beheadings were an act of terror, but exercised within the state, or should I say quasi-state. They have, as yet, no message to send to the US, no grievance with them. Unlike groups like Al-Qaeda, and again, emphasis on as yet. Their focus is solidifying their new nation, attacking Assad in Syria, repelling the Kurds and Shiite in Iraq. In all that, the US is a sideshow for them. Another risk people claim groups like ISIS pose to the West is the radicalization, the indoctrination of youth here in the West. The CBC has on many occasions harangued on the fact that a handful of Canadians have left the country to join Islamists fighting in the Arab world. In the UK, they are about to introduce new legislation to restrict and prevent nationals from joining or supporting foreign terrorist group. In Canada, we passed similar legislation a little while back. The RCMP have announced a new program to help identify, quote, extremist travelers as such people. Part of the fear is that such people will help, quote, our enemy, like Al-Qaeda or ISIS, that they will tarnish the reputation of Canada on the global stage. Although Harper's been doing a pretty good job of that on his own. Okay, but what if their worst scenario comes true? What if ISIS gains more territory? What if they could attack us in our homes? Isn't it just a matter of time before they take over the world? Or, as one enthusiastic, if unrealistic, ISIS commentator stated, raise the black flag of ISIS over the White House? Well, here we have the ultimate failsafe. ISIS is self-destructive. As with all radical groups, they're too pure, demand too much purity of others. Unlike Al-Qaeda and other jihadist groups, ISIS tolerates no dissension, tolerates no variation of the true word. ISIS has, beyond gaining a reputation for beheading, it has also taken people who are not Muslim, not the right kind of Muslim, and killing them, mass execution style. Just like in the French Revolution, where Paris fell under the control of the more and more radical groups, a time known as the Terror, spooky kind of, isn't it? Well, so it seems this part of the Middle East is suffering a similar fate. And like in Paris, at a certain point, the radicals were too radical, and such a minority, the moderates rose up with support of the majority and dispatched them. Thus, at one point or another, ISIS will either be replaced by a more radical cadre, if that's even possible, or they will wear out their welcome and be disposed from within. Okay, there is one important question we've yet to ask. Not that we should fear from ISIS, but what we should fear from the US response to ISIS. It is often a sad tragedy that the effects of American reaction has a greater deleterious effect than the act that actually prompted it. It is the irony of the American post 9/11 PTSD that have blown up the important and dangers of ISIS, that they will in earnest step up their military campaign. The US thinks they can use their planes and drones to beat down the Islamists, define that as you may, that it will stop popular support of these radicals who are in control of their land. Yet what happened when the US suffered a one-day attack from the sky? It united the US in a vengeful mandate where they willingly handed over all power to a cabal of radical militarists, the Bush cadre. What effect would living under years of attacks do to a person, a people? The only threat that ISIS poses to the West is the threat we ourselves create. I am sure at some point someone or more people suffering under yet another military campaign by the West on a Muslim country will actually hear what some American war hawks say. Do you remember that line? If we don't fight them there on their land, we will end up having to fight them here on our own. Well, at some juncture, there will be a breaking point, a point where it will not be our radicals, but their radicals saying, hey, that's right. If we started to regularly attack the US on American soil, they'll no longer be focused on the Middle East, but on themselves. Then you'll see terrorism like the UK suffered under the IRA, where you really had to look under your bed every night. So we're going to go for a little break. When we come back, we're going to talk not so much about ISIS, but the impact of Obama in his reaction to ISIS and the West's reaction to ISIS. Are we turning a molehill into a mountain? We'll return after this break.
That ship out there will be smashed to bits. Use your emergency equipment.
It won't work. Nothing works. It's got to. It's no use. Everything seems to be stuck.
My life's worth a try anyway. Come on, fellas. You can make it.
Just listen to this. Spider-Man saves freighter. You can't tell me the captain couldn't have brought his ship in without the help of that publicity-seeking show-off, Spider-Man!
Don't get caught wasting power. Unplug cell phone, camera, and other battery chargers when charging is complete. Many electronic devices continue to use power even when you are not operating them. The amount of energy consumed by electronics in a year when they were not in use could power Whistler Blackcomb Resorts for 43 years. This Power Smart play brought to you by BC Hydro Power Smart and CITR 101.9 FM.
Okay, we're back. We seem to have gone over a lot of the complexity of the issue. Irrespective of the complexity, it seems Obama has yet again shat on the Nobel Peace Prize he won just after becoming president. Why would I say this? Well, it seems in response to ISIS, Obama originally stated that it was largely a local issue and that it was best for the U.S. to take a wait-and-see attitude. This was exemplified by the comments Obama made at one press conference where he stated that he had no strategy to deal with ISIS. However, after the very public beheading of two journalists and a huge swing in public opinion, it appears Obama has found a strategy, and that is to make the next greatest threat to the U.S. So let's take a quick look at what he plans to do with ISIS. He stated that he will employ the same strategy that he has, in his words, worked so well in Yemen and Somalia. Somalia? The poster child for failed states? He pledged to do more airstrikes, and this is likely to include drone assassinations. How effective this would be on an army that is now reported to be anywhere from 20 to 80,000? Not all ISIS, but supporters of the Islamic State. Obama's airstrikes in Yemen and Somalia happen a couple times a year, at its peak, maybe a couple times a month. Regardless, it's not likely to have an impact at hurting such a large army. Now, to be fair, the highly centralized nature of ISIS does give the strategy of, quote, cut off the head and kill the monster, more credence. But not dealing with the underlying issues we have already discussed, it seems like, as any Hydra, a new and more radical head will step in to fill the vacuum. Now, they could provide classic air support, take out artillery or tank, but there are a few of those actually being used. And even if you do destroy a tank, you haven't actually taken the land. So air support without boots on the ground seems pointless. Now, the Peshmerga of the Kurds can and have offered resistance, and with air support have retarded ISIS advancements into Kurdistan. But they have no desire to take on ISIS beyond their own lands. There is the Iraqi army, which has already been defeated by ISIS. And by defeated, from most reports, the Iraqi army just threw down their arms and ran away or switched sides. Again, because of the sectarian tensions, Shiites are not willing to defend Sunni lands, and Sunni soldiers are more likely to choose to join ISIS. Obama says he will send in advisors to help train the Iraqi forces and arms to help equip them, which sounds nice until you remember that the U.S. has already been doing that for over a decade. That if they could not get the Iraqi army trained in that time frame, what could they possibly do now? Some fear that the U.S. may be drawn in. I should note that Canadian Special Forces are already on the ground, but although there is a lot of support now for the U.S. involvement in suppressing ISIS, there is still no support for sending in troops. Obama, in an eerie echo of Bush, has called together a coalition of the willing, so perhaps France or Canadian troops will be drawn into this quagmire. A quagmire we were smart enough to avoid the first time around, but it seems Harper likes to play in quagmires, irrespective of what may happen to our troops or our nations. Why a quagmire? Well, I repeat and remind that the U.S. occupied this region for about a decade and seems to have had no long-lasting positive effect. What a repeat could accomplish, I'm unsure. There have been comments made that after much arm-twisting, or maybe not, that some Arab nations are willing to help with air support. But the big apparent coup was Saudi Arabia has offered to provide training for for any Arabs who wish to help repel ISIS. Of course, beyond where the actual troops would come from, you might think the Syrian Free Army, but, well, they're pretty busy dealing with Assad. Also, there is the problem that Saudi Arabia is acknowledged as the primary source of radical Islam in the world. The government, well, really the monarchy of the Saudi Arabia, a long time ago, made an agreement with Muslim clerics of the Wahhabi variety of Islam that if they provided their blessing to the monarchy, the government would give them full rein to propagate their views. What's a Wahhabi? Quickly, they are fundamentalists who have a very radical view of Islam. They believe all the sects of Islam are apostates, and apostasy in Islam is a death sentence. That's the reason when terrorism and Muslim violence occurs in the Middle East, often Wahhabism has some connection. They deny tolerance of non-Muslims or anyone not a Wahhabi for fear it may weaken their own commitment to Islam. They are the reason people are regularly beheaded in rehab for blasphemy and witchcraft. 345 reported executions between 2007 and 2010, most of them beheading or stoning to death. Their only limitation being that they are still a minority in Saudi Arabia, at least among the populace. But, like in almost any number of Middle East nations, the ruling power is allied to a minority religion, each used to support the other against the majority. So, assuming Obama gets recruits to help fight ISIS, he is going to send them to a country that, by and large, if not directly supporting, although many think private members of the monarchy do provide financial support to ISIS and its kind, if not officially supporting ISIS, they have a very similar worldview. So there's a high probability if you manage to get recruits, turn them into soldiers in Saudi Arabia, they will do what the Sunnis in the Iraqi army did, join ISIS. So Obama now finds himself in an odd spot. In order to degrade and ultimately destroy the militants, known as the Islamic State, his words, not mine, he will need troops on the ground. There's little chance that Western nations will send enough troops. There's little chance the Iraqis will be able to be anything more effective than they've already been. The only Arab nation that's been willing to work with the U.S. to get rid of ISIS, the one power that can actually put troops on the ground and not face the same blowback U.S. troops would likely enlist, although there would be a blowback of a very different kind, is Iran. Yes, Obama's only effective potential ally is Iran. The great Satan and the axis of evil united in common cause? Of course, this is a square that Obama is unlikely to round, both diplomatically, let alone with Congress. But the only other effective force that could be used to attack ISIS is Syria. As mentioned earlier, there is some evidence that members, if not ISIS itself, was supported by Assad as a counter to the Free Syrian Army, but that relationship seems to have soured. And I don't think I've commented on this, but the term Free Syrian Army is a bit of a misnomer. One could be excused if they thought this was a united single force. It's not. It's a loose coalition of people, groups, and militia that want to depose Assad. If we go to our Wayback Machine, we would be reminded that when attempts were made to negotiate an end or at least a ceasefire in Syria, one of the biggest stumbling blocks was to find anyone, emphasis, anyone, to negotiate for the anti-Assad side. There was too much infighting for there to be any viable leadership on that side. Again, we should also be reminded that one of the reasons the U.S. has officially, until the ISIS crisis, hey, I just noticed you can't have crisis without ISIS, but seriously, officially the U.S. would not supply arms to the Free Syrian Army because they were unsure who would actually get the weapons. Maybe they would be moderates, or maybe they could be just as likely given to Al-Qaeda or ISIS. So by offering arms to the Free Syrian Army, and even giving them to the Iraqi Army, there's a good chance that a number of them will be given, sold, or taken by ISIS. But back to Obama's dilemma. Although it seems now that ISIS and Assad regime are fighting, there's no way Obama can support Assad to get rid of ISIS. And that also brings up another hypocrisy. The U.S. did not want to interfere, did not want to use a heavy hand, did not want to return to direct involvement in the region, this in the face of Obama's red line, chemical weapons, a line crossed and still no Western retaliation, this, along with the fact that tens of thousands of Syrians had been killed in the civil war, even when ISIS was conquering and killing hundreds of Iraqi and Assyrians to achieve their religious purity, the Western maintained a hands-off attitude, and one might think that's a good thing, or not. But two Americans get killed, and all hell breaks loose. This hypocrisy is not lost on at least one of the families of the killed journalists who have come out to protest that their son's death is being used as a rallying cry for military intervention, something they said their son would have been strongly against. And so, it looks like the West will once again interfere in the affairs of the Middle East, likely with the same outcome, more death, instability, and little progress. What makes me most upset is that there's not some force in this modern world ready to intervene, if only as a buffer between, simply as peacekeepers. But as the nation that invented peacekeepers, we have joined the Second Coalition of the Willing, thus wondering who could possibly play that role. China? Now that would be a game changer for sure. But to my point, the world should have intervened in Rwanda, Libya, Syria, and now Iraq. Not to change the government, not to make them friendly to the West, or for that matter, any particular interest. The UN peacekeepers should be sent in to keep the peace, protect the lives of locals, provide a space for diplomacy, to do what any one nation would be unable to do because of politics, economics, history, or what have you. Because of the failure of nations to play the role of peacekeepers, again, classic failures are seen in Somalia, Syria, Libya, there should be a movement to create a foreign legion under the direct control and leadership of the Secretary General of the UN. This force would need to be robust enough to defend itself against the likes of ISIS, the Syrian army, but not so large as to threaten other nations, nor to have the ability to actually control a nation. Their role would be to be keepers of the peace, policemen of the world. They would not run territory, but police it under a very minimal set of rules, such as preventing deaths or tortures of citizens. Local governments would be untouched beyond perhaps a call to negotiation and diplomacy. Sadly, the likelihood of the great powers, hell, even the minor powers, agreeing to this seems to be impossible, at least in the near future. We have reached a glorious time in our global ethical development. We have attained the moral knowledge that such acts of shooting one's own citizens is wrong, that people should be able to live free of the fear of death and torture. And yet, we have yet to discover the knowledge or wisdom to act on this moral knowledge. Such is the bane, the tragedy of the present humanity. And my apologies to our loyal listeners for having such a dark show, but it's finally come to an end. So until next week, this is Don saying, eyes open, minds on.
If you wish to make an apple pie from scratch, you must first invent the universe.
Thanks for listening to Radio Free Thinker. Remember to visit us online at radiofreethinker.com and subscribe to the podcast on iTunes. If you have any local skeptical events you would like us to mention on the air, email us at info@radiofreethinker.com.